back in just after World War II. I took advantage of the opportunity to get some GI schooling and had decided even before I left the parish, before going in the Navy, that I needed to know a whole lot more about how you help people before I tried to do much of it. And the Navy certainly convinced me that my hunch was right, because in the terrible, intense agonies and pressures that so often came up during the war with the men that I was supposed to serve, there's that desperation that comes when you want to help and everybody feels inadequate. And I was simply feeling the inadequacy that I think everybody feels. But the opportunity to go to school relatively free for a few years seemed to be just that open door that I needed to go ahead and get some extra experience and training. So I spent 4 years supposedly studying psychology and related things. But a good deal of the work was done in hospitals. It was clinical in nature. I, for instance, spent most of a year at Boston Psychopathic Hospital. It's called something else now in Boston. And a good deal of time at Massachusetts Memorial Hospital, which is a general medical and surgical institution, but across the street from the massive Boston City Hospital. Boston City Hospital was a typical large city, public, tax-supported hospital, which means a kind of a combination institution of mercy and a hellhole, all mixed up into one. Inadequate care for most of the people, some superb care for a few, but a place to be dunked again into the agonies of human beings. And we could move freely between Mass Memorial and Boston City. While I was working at Mass Memorial, I picked up a card one day, and I was there as a chaplain in training, clinical training. I picked up a card one morning in my box, and it gave a little 10-year-old boy, or 12-year-old boy, Bobby. And I went up to his room and discovered a little black boy with a great deal of charm, but a very sick little boy. And Bobby taught me probably more than I had learned before and maybe since about a great many things that have to do with the nature of illness and also perhaps with the nature of healing. Because it's a little hard to get at tomorrow's topic of the nature of healing unless we do some groundwork in defining what we're trying to heal. And Bobby taught me most of, I think, what I'm going to pass on to you today in one way or another. Other experiences and thoughts and readings and reflections have probably expanded on some of the things, but in my own mind, Bobby is the roots of most of that I know about these things. Bobby was in with a diagnosis of a kidney disorder that was probably going to be, and the prognosis was that he was probably going to die without getting out of the hospital, which turned out to be true. There was something about this little lad that was puzzling to everybody concerned. I contacted the doctor after my first visit to the little lad and asked him, what gives? And he said, well, he has a strange kind of a kidney disorder. His kidneys have been badly damaged, and we don't quite know why or how they got damaged. But we're trying to repair them and restore them to somewhat near normal function, but we're not doing very well with it. But he said, Padre, whatever you can do, you know, to cheer him up a little bit would be very helpful, because he's hurting and he's probably not going to live very long. Well, I don't think I would have needed the doctor's suggestion that I spend some time with Bobby, because he was just an attractive guy and a very fine human being. And after a while, he did me the great service of trusting me. So he would talk. Then we began to discover some things about Bobby. This infection and then subsequent damage in his kidneys was related to his father's alcoholism. Now we have to get back into the family a little bit. His mother was one of the most charming people, and also, incidentally, one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen. Very intelligent gal. She had been living on Cape Cod, and her family had been domestics for several generations in the homes of people like the Kennedys. I don't recall it was in the Kennedy home, but in that kind of people. And she herself had attracted the attention of some of these wealthy people because she was so brilliant and so charming. And she was the first black ever to be admitted to Wellesley. But she didn't get there. She just, Life magazine or whoever was writing things up at that time made a big deal out of this, that a black was going to be admitted to a New England Ivy League kind of a school. And it was a great story. She didn't get there because she was pregnant. It was discovered a few months before she was to start school. The father of the child turned out to be a young black man, also living near Hyannisport. He lacked almost everything that she had. He was not a very bright man and not a very well-motivated man. And, of course, the disgrace of this thing was just monumental, if you can understand. Having been written up in national magazines, you know, as the first black to break the color line and get into a place like Wellesley. And then she had to turn it down because of this disgraceful situation. The result was that Bobby's mother carried an enormous amount of guilt, which became a part of the ongoing problem and part of the ongoing story of Bobby. She married a man, and he never could hold a job, and so the family was very poor. They moved into Boston, and they lived in very, very meager, straitened circumstances, where hunger was a part of every day. There were just two children, Bobby and his little brother, who was about 3 years younger, something like that. The father would drift around trying to find some kind of work, and the most continuing employment that he had, as I recall, was taking the lead out of old batteries, breaking the cases and salvaging the lead out of old batteries. And you can imagine that's not a high-paying job, and it was a part-time job, and he had it only occasionally. Bobby's father's mother, his paternal grandmother, died and about a year after they moved into Boston, a year and a half. And Bobby's father became an instant alcoholic. Nobody had known him to even take a drink before the day that his mother was buried. Nobody ever saw him sober after that. He stretched out on the grave of his mother and clawed at the dirt, the mound, so that the grave diggers couldn't get there to shovel the stuff back into the over the coffin until they just dragged him away. The rest of the family and everybody finally decided there was nothing they could do with him. They might just as well go back home and let him work it out for himself and come home. When he came back home, he was drunk, and then that's from then on, he was drunk all the time. Just absolutely could not face this separation from his mother. Now that suggests then, you see, that there's a relational problem and an emotional problem, and just keep some of these things in mind as we go along. Because they're all result in a child who dies of what the doctors said was a kidney disorder. Now, the mother, when the father would come home, would take some terrible beatings. I saw her back one day when she came in, and I insisted that she let me see the results of a beating that he had given her the day before, and she had horrible bloody scars across her back, maybe 10 or 12 of them. He'd beat her with something like a stone poker or something of that nature. Because of her guilt feelings, she went on with it month after month, and as it turned out, year after year. The masochism that was rooted in her guilt feelings over her own personal guilt in having a baby out of marriage, her letting down of the race, and at a time when there were just the beginnings of some breakdown in those things, were very much a part of that woman's deep, pervading guilt, which had never been in any way dealt with. Other than to take the not unusual way out of allowing herself to get beaten up by life, in this case by her husband. When people said divorce him, you know, kick him out of the house or whatever, she was never able to do that, even when she would recover consciousness lying in a pool of her own blood on her kitchen floor. She couldn't call the police and couldn't lock him out of the house and couldn't force herself to get her divorce. Some way or another, she thought this is something that she deserved. Now, that was not very conscious. It occasionally became conscious. Bobby was a very sweet person, mild and tender, loving, sweet. He must have been terrorized by his father coming in drunk and then starting to beat up his mother. But Bobby would help his father into bed when the fussing around was all over, or very often would do this, take off his shoes, put a pillow under his head, and cover him up with a blanket when he was passing out or going to sleep. After his father had been an alcoholic for about a year, Bobby started to wet his pants. A kid was 11 years old or whatever, and a horribly embarrassing situation. And he'd been thoroughly toilet trained before, because Bobby's mother was a good mother in every way, and she had taken good care of these two kids. The other little kid, by the way, reacted entirely different to his old man. He would swear at him and say, "You black son of a bitch, get out of my way." And would throw things at his dad and then run faster than his drunk dad could chase him. But he remained healthy. Bobby began to retain his urine for unbelievably long times and never got to the bathroom quite in time. He because he would wait and wait and wait. Now, very often, deep anxiety will cause such things to take place. You try to maintain the status quo, even to the point of not passing urine. Just want nothing to change, because if you're safe at the moment, then don't let anything change. Don't go to the bathroom. And deeply symbolic things take place that sometimes make use of such things as defecation or passing urine. Well, there was a constant backwash into the kidneys. You see, the bladder was full, and the kidneys were always under a back pressure. And it was believed, finally, that this was what did the damage to the kidneys, and that ultimately resulted in his death. Now, the chart said that he was suffering from kidney damage due to unknown causes. He was being treated for kidney damage due to unknown causes. Now, that's not an easy thing to treat. If you don't know what causes the kidney damage, to try to treat it is obviously a problem. And the medical system is, even today, and this is a quarter of a century later, is not well set up to find out what the cause is. It knows what the symptoms are. It knows even what the disease is. And if you'll hang on, I want to make a distinction between disease and illness. Bobby had a kidney disease. To treat that disease, even if they treated it successfully, would never have gotten at his illness. His illness was a much larger thing than that. And the disease was a symptom of his illness. And this is the point that I'm trying to make. To get at his illness, you would have to take the plight of the black people, in his case now, in this specific thing, in their family. You would have to take an unfortunate pregnancy that brought together a brilliant, near genius woman with a man who was almost, and I suspect, borderline mentally retarded. You'd have to take the whole disgrace of the race that she was bearing on her shoulders. You had to take the alcoholic father, who had never been able to leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife. So when his mother died, he couldn't even leave the grave over her and leave her decaying remains. Well, they're just all kinds of things. But part of the illness is society's illness then, huh? It isn't only Bobby's illness, or Bobby's mother's illness, or Bobby's father's illness, or Bobby's maternal or paternal grandmother's illness and hanging on to her son, or whatever. Part of it was the whole milieu in which this family lived, and the poverty, the malnutrition, the anger, the burning resentments, the beatings. And then in the hospital, the illness of the hospital, in doing only those things that they were comfortable in doing, namely, to run the test to show that there was impaired kidney function, and then to try to find something that would increase the kidney function. And the result of all these illnesses, or this illness, which is the total situation, was that Bobby died. We didn't discover what caused him his terrible terror until he built up enough uremic poisoning and toxicity to become very delirious. And when I came into the room one day to see Bobby, he screamed and hollered and told me to get away quick before he gets you. And he climbed under his sheets and went way down to the bottom of the bed while he in just absolute terror in his delirium. And we spent a couple weeks trying to find out what he was afraid of and even who he was trying to protect me from, and it turns out it was his father. But obviously after a while, though he'd suspected that. It wasn't the kind of a thing that a urologist can treat. But the system was set up so that Bobby was to be treated by a urologist, and it was only by accident that a group of the rest of us got involved in one way or another. I found a social worker who was willing to think in somewhat unconventional terms about her role. And she went out of the hospital and went into the home. Now, this is more common today, but it was not common at that time. Social workers were primarily a financial protection to the hospital. They did some checking to find out by telephone to find out what the financial resources were, and if there weren't any, how in the world do you get some community agency to foot the bill? That's what social workers were doing in hospitals that day. Richard Cabot, who was one of the most famous physicians of medical history for all of that in this country, but certainly of that day, he's of the famous Cabot family in Boston, decided that one of the things he could do, because he had a lot of money tucked away, one of the things he could do with his life was to finance the education of medical social workers, because he had to have them to fit into this beginning concept of this of an illness etiology rather than just the disease. And so he financed out of his own pocket and very quietly 25 people through 2 years through their masters in social work, and then gave them at his expense 1 year working in a hospital under supervision of some very good people to try to turn out a good product. But when they started to go for the job, they ended up being financial advisors to the hospital on the solvency of the patient and not doing what Richard Cabot saw was necessary. Just to make that point a little stronger, I want to jump many years later and halfway across the country and at the Northern General Hospital, where I spent more than 20 years in Chicago. But a woman came in one day and was admitted with a serious heart attack, and was run through our emergency room and then up onto the coronary care unit, which is a very sophisticated, well-staffed, well-equipped kind of a unit with well-trained people, all the latest. And 30 days later, this woman who had really been seriously clobbered with a heart attack was ready, quotes, ready to go home. And when she was ready to go home, somebody said, well, we really don't, you know, we kind of goofed on this lady because we really don't know much about her, and she didn't participate in some of the group sessions that were offered. And so they felt a little ill at ease because they had failed a little bit in what that hospital happens to be dedicated toward. At least attempting to minister to this total human being. But they had they'd really not gotten acquainted with her as a person. And so they were terribly shocked. She went home around noon one day, and she came back the next morning, well, 3 o'clock in the morning, but she was dead on arrival. Well, that's a lousy thing, you know, just after a woman has been healed, and to have her within a few hours die of the thing that she was supposedly healed of. Now, it's not uncommon but it still shakes you up a little bit. Shook us up enough to say, what in the world happened here? At that point, we got a skilled social worker going on it. And the skilled social worker judiciously made some inquiries and finally found a situation that had killed her. The mother had a daughter, 12, 14 years old, who had made almost $12,000 selling drugs on the East Main High School parking lot in 1 year's time. The influential father and his very influential circle of friends had somehow or another managed to keep the girl out of jail. So there were repeated arrests on one charge or another, not so much the peddling part, because that was, most of that was revealed a little bit later. But the mother had been protected from this information and didn't know that her daughter, herself using drugs, but not heavily, but was peddling very heavily, and her mother didn't know that. They had managed to protect her from this information, and one night the police lost their patience or didn't read their instructions or something, and instead of protecting the mother who was home alone that night, they came to the house, rapped on the door, showed their badges, and said, "We're from the police department, and we have a warrant to search your daughter's room." "For what?" says the mother, because this came right out of the clear blue sky. "Well, for drugs." "Well, my daughter doesn't take drugs." "Well, we have a warrant for search for her room." They went up there and they found a whole bunch of cocaine and marijuana. And about an hour later, the mother had her first heart attack, which is a reasonable thing for a mother to do under circumstances like that. It's not an accident or anything. It's a kind of a almost predictable thing. Now, she was cured, not healed. I mean, the heart was, tissues were, it's hard to use these words, but let me use cured now. You hang on and try to keep these separated a little bit for the sake of our communication. But so the tissues did knit together, and you know the scar tissue wasn't all that bad, and everything was done, and a lot of oxygen poured into it, and all the chemicals and things that go to help. She went home without her knowing anything about this, and when she got home, she found out that her daughter was in a house of juvenile correction home because she had been picked up again in the 30 days that her mother had been in the hospital. She had been picked up again, and this time she was actually sentenced to a correctional institution. And the mother, just coming home thinking everything was fine because that's what the father and everybody else had been telling her all the time she was in the hospital, everything is just fine. "Oh yes, Mary is fine, no problems. You just relax and get well. You know, everything is fine. We're waiting for you to come home." And she comes home to find out her daughter's in jail. And that time she had a fatal heart attack. In spite of all the magnificent things that the medics did with that fine bit of equipment, that ambulance that comes up, and the telemetry that was employed to keep in touch with the cardiologist back at the hospital, all that kind of stuff. That mother's broken heart was too severely damaged to survive. Well, see, this was what Richard Cabot, way back around 1940, was trying to get established, was that it would be routine in illnesses, in hospitals, in the treatment, to get a good picture of the social structure in which the patient lives. So you treated the person not in isolation and not episodically, person comes into the hospital, stays there, what, 3 days, 5 days, 7.2 days was the national average at that time. I don't know what it is now. But then goes home and goes over the wall into oblivion again. Hardly know where they went. They just were discharged, cured. And Cabot saw through this and knew that this could not be. That's why he financed all of this. Do you know how many medical social workers he got employed out of the 25 that he financed through 3 years? Not one single one. And Cabot, who did a lot of great, wondrous things with his life, carried to his grave the terrible frustration over that kind of failure. And when I happened to talk with Cabot on the one occasion that I met him, I asked him how his social work program was going and wished I hadn't asked, because he was just furiously angry because this wasn't working at all, and wasn't working because hospitals wouldn't employ this kind of a social worker. That was none of their business. That's the job of the community out there, to have social agencies that keep in touch with families and, you know, all this kind of thing. The best that the hospital could do would be, for instance, maybe they could put a call into a family agency and say, hey, will you look in on that family? We suspect they got some problem. But no integrated treatment program. Now, a lot of this has improved in a great many places, but it hasn't improved all that much. Well, Bobby and I had a love relationship that I cherish as one of the most meaningful, significant, delightful things in my life, in spite of the tragedy in which it was bedded. When Bobby was, before he died, we had psychiatrists, social workers, urologists, family practice men. There were some other doctors I'm forgetting now. There were probably 9 doctors that were working together on this. Chaplain. And when Bobby died, the doctor who had been his attending physician suggested that we have a clinical pathological conference, which takes place in hospitals with regularity. It's a teaching device, among other things, in which the whole case is reviewed and everything that was done, and the positives and the negatives are all examined and evaluated. It's usually done after a patient is dead. Sometimes these take place after a patient is discharged from a hospital, but living. But the doctor suggested we have a clinical pathological conference, and so it was posted on the bulletin board. And the room in which these things took place was like a small boardroom or something of that nature. There was a long table in there, and there was room for maybe 20, 25 people in the room. And it never dawned on any of us that this wouldn't be large enough. But pretty soon, people started to come, and then the word got out around town, because already a lot of people in other institutions in Boston had heard that somehow or another a way had been found in which clergymen, social workers, physicians, psychiatrists, and some other people were working together, trying to keep one little boy alive. And now that they were going to evaluate this failure, a lot of people were interested in trying to find out what went wrong and what we had learned out of it. One of the most appreciated privileges and honors of my life was that when the CPC was finally arranged and finally was in a high school auditorium, because there were 300 and some people that came around Boston for this one, they asked me to preside and present the case at the conference. Well, you can't help learning out of all of that. I remember the day Bobby died, I had taped a little cross at the foot of his bed, and he had been unconscious for about 2 or 3 days, and he woke up and he looked at this little cheap, to me kind of offensive, luminous cross, plastic, but I taped it at the foot of his bed, and he looked up and he said, "Hello, Chaplain. I see my cross is still glowing." And he closed his eyes and died. Now, I don't know if there's any significance to that, particularly in the incident of the moment, but I know there was significance in it, in the totality of his treatment and his life. And Bobby probably died a very healthy little guy. His kidneys were gone. And the result of that was a poisoning of his system that caused his death. But his relationship with his mother, that had been always one that played out and acted out the guilt by her overprotection of this little guy, making him too sensitive to be alive. That had been healed. I remember one day when she took him and he was right in bed and he was very sick, and she shook him because he said a disrespectful thing to a nurse that came into the room. And I could have just jumped around the room shouting hallelujah, because here was a mother now free to be a mother instead of simply the slave of her guilt. We worked through that situation for 6 months after Bobby's death. A group of six of us met every week. After each one worked with Bobby's mother and was incidentally somewhat with the rest of the family. Now, out of that, some theories, hypotheses, and practices came at least into my own thinking and my own life. So when Lutheran General Hospital asked me sometime later to come and to be vice president in charge of doing what I pleased for a few years, I picked up the opportunity to suggest what health care ought to be about. And it was telling them about Bobby, really. That Bobby's illness, but all of these things, it wasn't just a kidney. It also gave me a chance to say that somehow or another we have to flush Cartesian view of man down the drain before we perish. And we ought to start in the church, of all places, the church to sucker in on a divisible human being, where you can toss the body over to the doctors in the hospital and throw the mind over to the teachers in the school and throw the soul over to the pastor, the priest, or the rabbi, and everybody does their own thing, and the poor person, you know, battered all over the place, separated. And none of these people ever, well, they're beginning to talk to each other, but they don't talk to each other very much, huh? Even within hospitals, very often you'll find a hospital in which, even today, doctors and chaplains, psychiatrists, social workers seldom have any significant clinical conversations about the patient that they're all seeing individually. Instead of making a group diagnosis. Another example. A woman came into the hospital one day, and strikingly handsome woman, 45 years old. She had it happened by accident. She also had a kidney disorder, a kidney infection. The chief of the medical staff came to me and said, Fritz, I've got a woman that I've never met before, but she was referred in here by somebody, and she has a severe kidney infection, but I can cure it in 5 days, but I've just been sitting and talking with her for an hour, and I'm uneasy about it. So can we form a cadre, which was term that we were using at the time for a little ecological team where we put together physicians, psychiatrists, social workers, chaplains, etc. And each one made their own, got acquainted with the patient, and then we sat down and made a group diagnosis of the illness, not just the disease, and then determined a mode of treatment and who was carrying what role when. Well, he said, I'd like to have a cadre formed on this one. So we did. And the doctor reported right away to the group all of his physical findings and the results of the tests coming out of the lab. And it was clear that she had a rather common but serious infection of the kidney. And then the psychiatrist went in and he came out and said, wow, this woman's an alcoholic. Do you know how she got the kidney infection? She got it by getting roaring drunk at a party a few nights ago, a week ago or so, and her husband was thoroughly disgusted with her because he was embarrassing her, or him, she was embarrassing him, and when she stumbled out the door, he let her go, and it was a cold, rainy spring night, and she fell down in a snowdrift during a spring rainstorm and was there for almost the whole night. And she got one horrible cold and then out of this, finally a kidney infection related to the cold and the chill that she had gotten. Well, the social worker then wanted to check this out to make sure. I mean, and the psychiatrist at that time didn't know. He knew she was an alcoholic because he was a specialist in alcoholism. And he just said, hey, there's no question this gal is an alcoholic. She doesn't admit it, but she is. It was the social worker who confirmed this by going to the home, and he went to the husband. She went to the husband and said, your wife's in the hospital, and we could get her out of there in about 5 days, but we're concerned that she may have bigger problems than the kidney infection. And we would like your permission to keep her there for a longer time, and it's going to cost a lot more money because we're going to have a lot more people involved. So we want your permission on it. And he said, I don't care how long you keep her. Just keep her out of my sight, and I'll pay the bill. Social worker also reported that they lived in the Gold Coast apartment in North Shore in Chicago, upper Michigan Avenue, way, you know. And his and her Cadillacs parked in the garage underneath the building, and a daughter at a boarding school up in Wisconsin that wouldn't speak to either one of them. Well, that looked like maybe it could fit into something also, huh? So then I was sitting down with a woman and found that all she wanted to do was commit suicide. Why shouldn't I drink? All I want to do is die. Life was so miserable for her. Oh, where's the misery? You live in a Gold Coast apartment, you got a Cadillac, a husband who pays every bill that you ever want to run up. What are you talking about, lady? And she said, well, there's just no meaning, and I'm headed down. Well, what do you mean headed down? She said, well, I'll have to tell you where I came from. She was born in a slum area in Chicago, an unusually beautiful girl, which made it possible for her to marry one step up the economic ladder, as often happens. Somebody put, you know, in a kind of a Pygmalion thing, put a nice clothes on her and got her to a hairdresser, and she was a doll. But somebody with a bigger bank account bought her away by way of a divorce procedure and, you know, whatever, and remarriage. So she married up the ladder. She'd had 4 marriages prior to the one she was in, so this was her 5th marriage. But she had been looking in the mirror in the last year or two, and she had decided that she would never have a better marriage in terms of the economics of that kind of marriage, because now she was beginning to show a little bit of age. And so she was going to go down the next one, and she knew that that would be a faster trip than the one that went up. All she wanted to die instead of going back to the slums, which was the image at the back of all this work. Well, what's the problem? See, where's the illness now? Again, all kinds of things are the illness, huh? Kidney disease, in this case, the infection, was simply a symptom of a larger illness that was a deep, pervading, very tragic thing. But at the very bottom of the whole thing was her sense of values. Because her good looks and living in Gold Coast apartment and driving a Cadillac and having lots of money made her feel she was worth something. When she was going to lose that, there was no sense in living. There was no value in life. And nobody had ever told her that God loves you, or that your worth is established by one who died on a cross one day. That's what you're worth. You're worth God. Because the only time a price has been set, it was set with God dying on a cross. Now, when she finally laid hold of that kind of a fact, then she did some celebrating for a while, and a lot of things happened. And one of the great pleasures of our Christmas season each year is to get a card, and this goes back over more than a decade now, a card from the family, and usually it's something like a picture of the family, the three of them, sitting at the fireplace or something, you know, in a beautiful home, and with their arms around each other, and then there's always a handwritten note about how good life is. And they, that's a success story, unlike the one I told you a little bit about the coronary case, where it was just plain failure and stupid failure. That death should not have taken place. Now, these are examples that I think say what I want to say about the nature of illness. Illness is a personal thing. It involves the person, not simply the organ. You can cure a disease which is probably located in an organ. That's why I have to use words like that. Cure, disease, that is in a specific part of the body. But the need is for healing, because illness is the problem. Anybody who's worked much in hospitals has seen these so-called thick chart patients. Now, these are people. You drag their charts out and you find out that they were in 6 months ago with a different disorder. And a year before that, they were in with a different disorder yet, but they keep on accumulating one disease after another. And if you do some research on those things, you usually find pictures like I've been just describing, where nobody got at the illness part. So they have to keep on having these diseases. A little theology would help. Healthcare, enormously. But there is no theology of medical care, unless we add it or have it ourselves. But it isn't a part of medicine, unless the absence of a theology is a theology in itself. It is a statement about God's place in human existence, if you pay no attention to God in human existence. Well, in the beginning, you know, God created. Then at some time point, I don't know if those words are even permissible in talking about eternity, but at some place, God said, "Now, let us make man in our image." And so he formed us out of the dust of the ground. It's, you know, for
for centuries, Christians got stuck at that point. And for a good part of this century, we argued about how long that sculpturing act took, longer than what Wayne has to take to chisel out that thing that he's working on up there, even, probably. Well, you know, is it a question of how long it took God to do this, 24 hours or 24 zillion years? That's not the point of it at all. The point is that God made us because he wants us. And if we get that through our thick brains, we'd be a much healthier people. To live in the consciousness that we are wanted by God is probably the most healing thing that there is. To walk as one of his, inescapably his, that we can't run fast enough to get away from him because he chases us and grabs us and enfolds us in his arms. Walk with that. And even if you get sick, you're not going to get awfully sick. You may even die. No, you can't die, can you? That's the one thing you can't do. Dying is the way to life. Well, the significant part is that after he formed us out of the dust of the ground by whatever process, I happen to think it was an evolutionary process. I don't discard everything else I'm going to say if you don't agree with that. He breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and so man became. Now, it depends on which version you read in this one. If you read the old King James, and so man became a living soul. The newer versions don't use that. They say living being. Do you know why? Because Descartes had defined soul as a part of a human being, and the biblical scholars couldn't settle for that one. Because soul, most often in Scripture, refers to the totality of the person, not to some fraction of his being. Descartes has had profound influence. Well, the Greeks first, and he refined a Greek idea about this partitionable human being, body, mind, and soul, and all that. Fractioned off into parts, and you toss the parts around to the experts or to the specialists or whatever in some place. A person either gets dragged along and then ignored or left behind or something. But when they were going to translate this, because soul, to everybody's ears and minds, meant a fraction, a part, something other than the body and other than the mind. And this was soul, whatever that strange, mysterious thing is. Now, so they translated this nefesh kaya. Man became this nephesh. They translate it as living being, which is about as silly as you can get, because that doesn't say anything. No. Is there any distinction between that verse in Genesis and, for instance, a verse that could be written about the origin of an ant or a jackal or a rattlesnake or an elephant or a petunia? God didn't breathe into their nostrils the breath of life and make them this related being, inseparably related to God. So that's the meaning of the creation, isn't it, of a human being? One of the Dead Sea Scrolls says that he made us for his eternal company, which I think is a beautiful statement. Well, we had to kind of knock it out of shape because we let Descartes define a biblical term. Biblical anthropology presents a human being that is indivisible and inseparable. You cannot unplug his parts. We talk a lot about wholeness. And very often, healing is equated with the term wholeness or coming to wholeness. I am not happy with that. It has a lot of use in our thinking our way through, but what if you can't be whole? Wholeness has some limitations, some practical reality factors in it. Try to tell a guy like I tried to tell once. Professional football player, nationally acclaimed for some of his magnificent feats on a football field. Three young boys just coming towards late childhood, approaching adolescence. And the guy has a knee injury and an infection in the knee and horrible problems on that thing, and he has to have his leg amputated. Try to tell him, you know, that he's whole. It's a little difficult. Try to tell my daughter, who told me once that the only thing she wanted in life was to be a good Christian mother. Try to tell her the day after she had a hysterectomy, before she'd had a child, that she's whole. It's a little difficult. There has to be something beyond wholeness. And we'll get at some of that tomorrow in the fullness, but let me double back now. I'd like to be very critical for a while of present healthcare systems. Part of it is because of our bad theology. We have gone along with a divisible human being where we have been content to say ours is a spiritual ministry to the souls of men, which is a horrible distortion of what is implied in Scripture. Ours is a ministry to total human beings. Otherwise, I'm going to have to cough and sputter and shut up when we come in the creed to saying, and I believe in the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting. Whatever that means, it certainly means that there is this final reunion joining together to be perfect again. It's the great shalom. So much loses its meaning if we don't see this total human being that Scripture presents. And if we try to accommodate ourselves to a cultural distortion of biblical anthropology. Now, on the basis of that, we have allowed, even in church hospitals, we've allowed this easy separation between the medical and the spiritual take place. The patient suffers as a result. Now, this is worse in our day than it's ever been in any day because there are more people in hospitals. There are more people in hospitals for a lot of reasons. One of them is that we can afford it. One of them is that, you know, with our insurance plans and everything, we can not only afford it, but we better bloomin' well patronize those hospitals. What's going to happen if all those hospital beds accommodated only people who need to be in the hospital? Financial disaster for every hospital in the United States. At least a third of the patients that are in any hospital, in my opinion, at least a third. Of all the patients in any hospital on any given day, do not belong there at all. They're there for economic reasons, not for health care reasons. That is, they're there because you can get the bill paid if you're going to the hospital. You can't get a bill paid if you're there. You're there because the doctor can much more conveniently serve you and make even more money by seeing many more patients if he's got them concentrated within, you know, one floor of the hospital, of a hospital at one point in geography. We go into the hospital because, well, after a while, after all, we paid for it. I deserve it. I'll use it. We try to stay in the hospital after the doctors and nurses try to kick us out because the insurance hasn't run out yet. I might as well stay. It can be a kind of a knife's life if you're not sick. Even if you're sick, it's a very comforting place. And a lot of people don't want to leave the womb syndrome that enters into our being tucked into a bed and having nice nurses tuck us in and cuddle us in and stroke us. Now, they don't do the important things. I suppose there's some nurses here that are going to really tie out of me. Most important things that nurses can do for patients, I think, are back rubs, baths, and bed making. You can hire computers to do the rest of it pretty soon, if not now. But who's going to touch you with a sacramental touch that says, I love you? I had a infection after surgery once. That's a funny story. Let's take a minute for it. I was going to go to Africa for a year to look at bush hospitals, and the doctor said, hey, is that hernia still bothering you? And I said, well, it bothered me. Kind of fun, and he said, you get in before you go to Africa. That's, you know, that's too much of a hernia. And I was popping out of this opening and hip. So I said, all right. And he examined me and he said, I'll get the surgeon. Do you want to pick him out or should I get one? I said, well, I pick him out. Not that big a deal for me. And he said, all right. And he picked the surgeon. He said, a good one. The surgeon took a look at me and he said, you say you're going to Africa for a whole year? Yeah. Well, let's do both sides. The other side doesn't look all that good either. And I said, well, I don't see anything wrong with that side at all. And he said, well, let's do it because you don't want to run any risk of anything like that happening in the middle of Africa in a bush hospital. Well, because I followed his advice and let him do both sides, I got an infection on the elective side. The other side came up, and all fine, no problem, but the elective side developed a horrible infection with a well-educated staff oriented bug. It had been not only university training, it was graduate school training. It had been subjected to every antibiotic known to man, and there was nothing that would touch it. They finally ended up treating me for 6 months in the hospital. I didn't get out for 6 months. Washing me like a laundromat operation with soap instead of all this modern stuff, you know, the fancy antibiotics. Well, so I get over to Africa finally, and then they discovered that if I'd had the hernia surgery over there, I would have had a simple staph aureus at the most, and they could treat it with ordinary penicillin, which is practically useless in this country against these infections. And I would have had no problem. I would have been out of the hospital in a week and walking around if I'd had this in a bush hospital in Africa. Not only because of lack of bugs, but there was another factor in it, and that is that over there they really know something about hernias because all these kids eat so much starchy stuff. And they get great big bellies from these. Well, you see every little African kid, even if he's starving to death, got a great big belly, and pretty soon the muscle wall stretches out very thin, and they pop a hernia on this. So hernia is the most common thing in a bush hospital in Africa. So they have to go and know how to do this, and you get a medical assistant who has had 2 years of on-the-job training in a hospital, and they have done thousands of these, and they do them very well, and you get treated very easily. The main disease that I want to end up with is the neurotic attitude we have towards illness in this country. country. We are obsessed with health. And if we'd get over that, we'd be a lot healthier. You pick up any magazine, any TV show, anything, it's the most nauseating thing. You can't find a place to look, but you see something that's going to protect your health from something, huh? And we are nervous all the time walking around. What's going to hit me next? Tension is one of the most destructive factors in our lives today. In this society, now, we're research, cancer research, for instance, has been turning a corner gradually for the last 3-4 years. You've heard about interferon. This may be one of the links. They're not sure about that yet. But there is strong evidence that tension will suppress the immune system in the human body and allow, in this case, cancer to get its start. This is where most of the new direction research is taking place today.